Hello and welcome to another episode of Football Memories and Moments. Thank you very much to everybody that's retweeted or listened or spread the word. I think we've had a really good start to Series 3, not American season, none of that nonsense. And I just want to say thank you to everyone that is. And obviously, if you are listening through Apple Podcasts, we'd be very, very grateful if you could rate 5 stars, because that does just kind of throw us up the charts and just throws out that exposure a little bit more. This week we're joined by Leon Mann. Leon is a very experienced football journalist, writer, reporter. He's covered Bundesliga, Europa League, he's covered the Olympics, he's covered the European Championships for the BBC and ITV. But I think more importantly, he's the founder of the Black Collective of Media and Sport, as well as the Football Blacklist, which has recently celebrated some huge, huge events and awards that celebrate that side of the game, and trying to promote an anti-racism within football, and trying to promote more black people into football journalism, etc., etc. And it was great to chat to Leon, because I think he's a really interesting fella. And it was great to get another World Cup memory. I think quite a lot of people, the World Cup is still this big thing, but for Leon to see the reggae boys of Jamaica at France 1998 was something big for him. But he's still, you know, very much a London boy. And he talked about going to see Spurs winning the Cup in the early 90s and what it like to be a Tottenham fan then. And I just thought it was a really good chat. It was a Skype interview, so sometimes these things don't always end as well as you'd like. There's obviously sometimes interference, but you know that now. But I hope you enjoy it as much as I do. And yeah.
My big memory from football, I've been to hundreds and hundreds of games, but actually my memory unusually is about a game I didn't go to. I actually ended up watching it on a TV in a bar in Finsbury Park, and it was Jamaica versus Croatia. My mum's from Jamaica. As a youngster, we always went to Jamaica every other year to see my grandfather and family from Jamaica as a family. And I have fond memories of going back to Jamaica, as a young man, and, getting to know the country, getting to understand the culture, getting to connect with the culture, as someone of mixed heritage, Jamaican, and I guess Anglo-Irish, if that is such a term. I was very interested in exploring identity, and filling out, you know, who I was, I guess, in many respects, as a person. So having a connection with Jamaica, a direct connection with Jamaica, was something that was really important to me. And to see Jamaica qualify for a World Cup, follow that campaign, closely, was really, really special. And the fact that we had players such as, you know, Robbie Earle, Paul Hall, Marcus Gayle, Frank Sinclair, you know, essentially British guys who, like me, had a direct relationship with Jamaica through their parents, actually gave me more of a connection with the Jamaica experience. And I just dreamed of being one of those guys, and you know, having the opportunity to go to a World Cup and wear that yellow top. And you know, I still live in North London, grew up in North London. So the Jamaican communities were glued to football screens in a way that I hadn't really experienced in the past. My team is Tottenham Hotspur, and most of my mates of Caribbean and African heritage all supported Arsenal, because they had Ian Wright and then Thierry Henry, and you know, they had a history of black players. I guess at the time Tottenham certainly didn't. So there was an opportunity to watch football and share something with some of my other mates from different backgrounds that I hadn't previously had before. But yeah, so me and my dad were desperate to go to a Jamaica game. And I remember at the time I was studying for my A-levels. I spent all day on the phone trying to get tickets, all day for 2-3 days. And didn't manage to, and it's absolutely gutted that I didn't manage to get tickets. So I had to find another way to experience this huge game against Croatia. So I ended up going with my best friend Daniel, who isn't of Jamaican heritage and actually quite enjoyed supporting Croatia on the day, I remember, going to a bar in Finsbury Park, and to see Robbie Earl score that goal and do, you know, his famous celebration with his arms spread wide after to scoring for Jamaica, was a huge, huge memory for me. Just the fact that I've got to know through the industry the likes of Robbie, Paul Hall, Marcus Gale and Frank Sinclair, and hearing what it meant to them, you know, directly and having a direct relationship. I'm not suggesting I'm great mates with these guys, but to have some kind of relationship actually has made that memory, you know, even more special to me. And I look back fondly on, you know, Jamaica at the 98 World Cup and the different atmosphere that it brought to a World Cup, to have big sound systems playing, you know, in and around games, you know, the whole carnival atmosphere that was brought to football. And that's a different carnival atmosphere to what we would have seen with Brazil's, etc. You know, it's really, really special. And although, you know, ironically, I wasn't there to experience it directly, I still felt like I experienced it through others and through the way the story was told on the television. I have fond memories of a Channel 4 documentary following the British players going back to play for Jamaica on that World Cup journey. And yeah, it's just a special, special memory, and something that will never ever leave me.
So the scene is you're 18, and had you been well travelled as an 18-year-old, or was that something that just wasn't available to you going up to the age of 18? Did you go abroad? Did you obviously other than going, you know, back to your family, your family home, and in Jamaica, were you well travelled? Was the idea of just booking tickets and disappearing off to France, was that quite alien to you as well?
I mean, I was relatively well travelled compared to some of my mates at school at the time. You know, I think my dad is a bit of a hippie, so spent a lot of time backpacking around Europe and stuff. So I was kind of, you know, obviously a very working class guy, but very invested in the idea of opening your mind to different cultures and traveling around when you can. So as a family, although we weren't, you know, anywhere near wealthy or rich in any way, you know, my old man would always find a way for us to travel somewhere, be it, you know, if it might be camping in France, it might be going to Cyprus for a holiday because we lived in a Cypriot community in North London. So my dad was keen for us to actually go to Cyprus so I could speak to my friends at school about their country and experience their culture. So the idea of going over to France was exciting, of course, because I'd never watched a football game at 18 internationally. And to think of doing that, you know, for this very special occasion of seeing Jamaica there was hugely attractive, and hence the massive disappointment when the phone would just keep ringing and ringing. And I remember it was a big theme at the time. It was all over the news because obviously England were at the 98 World Cup and everyone was experiencing the same thing. And, you know, interestingly, in and around the communities of Tottenham and Haringey, where I was brought up, everyone was experiencing the same thing. It's only later on that I, you know, as I've emerged, well, as I've immersed myself into the football industry, that I've met people who said, oh, no, we organise coaches and we organise all sorts of ways to get out there, and we bought our tickets in blocks, and, you know, it was fairly easy. But I just wasn't plugged in at that time to people who would be able to get tickets for a World Cup. And, yeah, I'm very, very, I was going to say, yeah. Jealous,
yeah,
of them having that experience.
And rightly so. I would just immediately take the default position, Leon, the lion. They made it up just to make you feel bad, so forget them. One of the things that we've had across both series, and I think particularly if I look back to the Ian McIntosh and Andy Brassel episodes about not so much absent fathers in terms of in life, but absent footballing fathers
that led to these two making their own footballing decisions. It's kind of come the other way with your dad, is that it was an invested thing. How did he react? What was his pride? How did he react to A, Jamaica being in the World Cup, but also B, not being able to get there?
It's an unusual one because, I mean, my dad, you know, his background is his mother was Irish and his dad was English. And, you know, my mum is the Jamaican parent.
Yeah.
But, you know, he was equally disappointed because, you know, he'd spent years and years going to football at Tottenham Hotspur. You know, going to games, you know, when he was a student, at Chelsea, you know, experiencing football in a particular way, in a very British way, you know, and that's not a complaint, at all, but this was an opportunity to experience football in a completely different way. And you know, while my dad's not Jamaican, you know, he spent a lot of time, in Jamaica. So he had a, you know, strong connection with Jamaica as well. So he was, you know, deeply disappointed in the fact that we couldn't get tickets. And, you know, I think it feels like a missed opportunity, but the fact that memory is still so special to me that despite having to watch it in a very average pub in Finsbury Park with my best mate who was supporting Croatia pretty much to wind me up, you know, it still stands out as a really, really special memory to me. And my football experiences, and I've been lucky enough to go to, you know, some of the biggest games on earth, be it, you know, like World Cup finals to, you know, European Cup finals, Olympic 100 meter finals, you know, big sporting moments. But actually, when I think back, you know, that is certainly, top of the pile.
So if we come to the game itself, but I just want to investigate one aspect. I'm assuming your mum was she interested in football, or was she just more interested in the fact that Jamaica were there, or she just didn't care either way?
Yeah, no, my mum was interested in Jamaica being at the World Cup. You know, my dad's obsessed with sport, so there's no getting away from it in our house. So and my mum's, you know, interested in football. You know, she always surprises me with actually how much she knows, given that she wouldn't certainly call herself a football fan, but the fact that Jamaica were there made it really, really interesting. And, you know, it was really, you know, nice, I guess, for me as a young man at the time to see my mum engage with football more, because while she would, you know, support Tottenham Hotspur, which is the club of our family, while she would, you know, engage with whatever sport was on the television, you know, there wasn't necessarily that connection. I don't think my mum would necessarily say she massively cares about Tottenham Hotspur in a way that, you know, maybe my old man and myself would. So actually to share that kind of experience of, you know, supporting a team together, something that I always had with my old man from being a young kid and being taken to games, being taken to training, etc., was very special.
Right, let's move on to the game, and I'm just looking at the squad, and what's impressing me is that there's a healthy mix of second generation players, but there's also quite a lot of Jamaica based players, isn't there? It seems to be a good mix of the squad. I know Ian Goodison at the time was still playing back in Jamaica, but went on to become the ultimate scrammy legend. I think he's up there with Johnny King on some days. But it was a good mix of squad. What was your feeling going into that? Did you have any idea to think of how they were going to do, or were you just hoping for the best?
Yeah, I mean, it was very much like a feeling of hoping for the best. I mean, you know, 18 years old, you know, I would have, which I was at the time, I was reading absolutely everything on football that there was to read. We didn't have the internet back then, so it was all reading, you know, magazines, listening to radio shows, watching every bit of football that was available on TV, which was a lot more limited back then than obviously it is now. And I remember I was really excited about another guy who I've got to know, you know, pretty well, Ricardo Gardner. Because there was talk about Ricardo Gardner at the time going to PSG, because, you know, they recognised that he was a big talent. Obviously, he went on to sign for Bolton and have a great Premier League career. But you know, this kind of like left wing back player who had loads of skill, strength, pace, and you know, the fact that he hadn't come from Britain, you know, and was still like a standout player, if not the best player in the team, I found it fascinating and fantastic. It was like, gosh, we've got this whole world of other footballers that haven't been tapped up in the UK. They haven't been brought over to play football in the UK. And isn't it exciting to think that we could be seeing more and more talent come from Jamaica over into England? I didn't even think of it in European context at the time, to apply their trades here. And wouldn't it be great to kind of like get behind them and feel like a connection to them? You know, it's interesting that since Ricardo, you know, I'm trying to think of other Jamaican players that have made a real impact. I think you could only really talk about Leon Bailey, you know, who's currently at Leverkusen, as being the next Jamaica player to make a real impact this side of the pond, and you know, on a top level, I'm talking about. So yeah, that fascinated me, and you know, you kind of, there was a, I'm just thinking back to that team now. You know, you became so familiar with the guys at the time. You know, I couldn't tell you an awful lot about some of them now, but at the time, you know, you mentioned Ian Goodison, like, you know, you kind of like read up every bit of information on these guys at the time and kind of were a sponge to them and, you know, wanted to know more and just had those question marks. Oh, but can they do it against the best in the world? And actually, no, if they work hard and just give the ball to the British players and maybe we'll get through. And of course, you know, they beat Japan. Jamaica. People forget about that. You know, they obviously got beaten by Argentina, but to beat Japan, you know, when you look at where Japan are now and even then, it was a huge, huge achievement.
So I was going to just come on to that a little bit later, but it's nice to raise how it finished. But we'll talk about the game itself. Now, it seems we're the same age, and I'm looking at the dates here. And I know that it was definitely because if I remember rightly, the Jamaica game was before the England-Tunisia game. And I was definitely sat in a PE exam during the England-Tunisia game. So just disappearing off to the pub. Now, the other question is, were you a young 18 or an old 18? Because wandering into the pub, did you get challenged on that? What was that like?
No, I mean, to be honest, my best mate, you know, he still looks about 13 at the moment. So he had all the problems. I had the bum fluff going on, so I was just about able to get in. But no, I mean, you know, I remember, I think we were definitely both 18 and had our, you know, legitimate IDs. I think the fake IDs had been chucked away by then. So we were all good. As long as I went to the bar, and it would just be quickest to get the drinks because the ID wasn't needed. But it was an interesting time because, like you say, I was doing my A levels at around that time, which, you know, I found, you know, really challenging. I messed up my A levels maybe because of this World Cup, but. It was really interesting and significant summer for that reason. But there was a World Cup, and I do actually remember just, you know, being in those A level exams, thinking, well, I need to get out of here because there's a game on. You know, I can't miss that game, and you know, I've just got to go. And I won't share my A level results on here because it may make me unemployable for some employers. going forward, but
you should have just done what someone in our peer exam, and he will remain nameless, but the teachers did wonder why he was lent on his hand for the entire exam, wondering how he could be comfortable, but they didn't realise he'd snuck a Walkman in, and had the game on, because a teacher actually walked around our exam hall,
amazing,
giving a score updates for the game. But he leant forward in the exam and said, I knew that 20 minutes ago. I was like, oh, right, okay. So anyway, the game kicks off now. This is an interesting thing because it's almost kind of, this game is sharing the history a little bit. You know, there's a huge focus on Jamaica as the reggae boys and the culture you're going to bring, such a massive achievement. But then there's also eyes on Croatia because this is the first time they've qualified for a World Cup. It's the first time they're really in, that, you know, they're a new nation. What was, when Stanage scores, what was the feeling?
Well, when Stanage scores, I was just thinking, oh geez, this could be a long game here, you know, because from what I remember, Jamaica had done reasonably well, they had competed quite well, and no one knew really what to expect because, you know, Croatia, I think, were by far the favourites over Jamaica. Jamaica were the minnows in that game for sure. I mean, you know, within the community in Tottenham and in Haringey, you know, everyone was talking up Jamaica's chances, but that was just all based on emotion. You know, when you looked at the fact that they had, you know, Davor Suker and Prozenecki and, you know, all those kind of well-known seasoned big players in the Croatia side, you know, it was always going to be a massive task to get anything from that game. So when that goal went in, it was kind of just a feeling of, okay, well, let's just hope this remains a respectable scoreline. But then, of course, you know, then Robbie Earl rocks up, and that was just a huge moment, you know, because in the pub I was in, actually, it wasn't packed to the rafters with Jamaica supporters at all. There were some people in there, you know, in the Jamaica colours. But I think I just picked a pub that actually didn't have a Jamaica community that was connected to it. But obviously, I think everyone was quite keen for Jamaica to do as the underdogs. You know, it was almost everybody's second team because it was like, oh, it's Jamaica, harmless Jamaica, fun Jamaica. You know, when you think of Jamaica, you know, the associations of Bob Marley, sunshine, smiles, beaches, you know. So I think there was a will for the reggae boys to do well. So, you know, when Robbie put that in, you know, it was so, so good. It was just an amazing feeling. And I remember, you know, I'd gone out and bought the shirt because it was, you know, I've still got that shirt. I can just about squeeze into that shirt now as well, which is going absolutely nowhere. That shirt will never, ever leave my possessions in my life. And, you know, just wearing that shirt, just feeling so proud to be connected to Jamaica because, you know, at the time, I mean, was I an England supporter? I'm born here, you know, I want England to do well. And I, you know, wanted to have a greater connection with England than maybe I have now that I certainly didn't have as an 18-year-old because it kind of felt like you were always being, you know, questioned on, you're an England supporter, but how English are you? You know, because, you know, A, you're black, mixed race, but how English are you? You know, I think the treatment of, you know, John Barnes in and around that time, you know, the late 80s, early 90s, you know, I still remember, you know, there being monkey chants at the old Wembley, you know, when John Barnes got the ball. Certainly loud booing. So to have a connection, you know, as a black guy with the England team was quite hard. Mm-hmm. Despite there being England players, black England players, you know, it's quite hard to kind of feel that kind of connection. And I know many, you know, black guys, you know, had that connection who were older than me and, experienced a lot worse racism than I have faced. And, you know, just kind of took the attitude of, look, I'm English. Of course I've got a connection with the England football team. Of course I want them to do well, but I actually really struggled to support England for a long time. Now I think the dynamics changed. But, you know, the fact that Jamaica had come along at that time when I was struggling with my connection to England, you know, just made it mean, you know, all the more, to me that Jamaica, were at a World Cup and, you know, that moment when Robbie scored, I was like, oh my gosh, we might actually get something from this game.
And that sadly didn't last too very long, did it? But it's taken two legends of the Croat game to beat in the end in Prozenecki and Davor Suker. But just to finish then, Liam, what was that feeling after the World Cup? What was your feeling as an 18-year-old mixed heritage black man who was supported the country of his ancestors? How did you feel come the end of that whole tournament?
I mean, the feeling after the tournament was, you know, it felt like there was a gap because the journey was over. You know, that World Cup journey had finished. But there was also an excitement because, you know, I was excited about following, you know, those players that had emerged from the tournament, like a Ricardo Gardner. I had a greater connection with people like Robbie Earle, Marcus Gayle, Frank Sinclair, Paul Horn, Dion Burton, Fitzroy Simpson. You know, these players I was suddenly interested in. You know, I felt a connection to them. And I was kind of, you know, reasonably optimistic about going forward, thinking, oh, wow, okay, well, you know, if Jamaica can build on this, you know, I wonder what they could do at the next World Cup, because, you know, there's plenty of guys who are playing in England, who are British, who have a similar, you know, heritage. So they could go on to play for Jamaica as well. And you never know what could happen. You could really build something here. Sadly, that didn't happen. And a load of people went on to play from Jamaica. Like, you know, two of my really good mates, Darren Moore is a very good friend of mine, as is Michael Johnson, who's played for Derby and Birmingham. Both of them went on to play for Jamaica. Numerous others, like Joby McAnuff, who I went to school with, he made the decision pretty early to go and play for Jamaica. Richard Langley went on to play for Jamaica. So many players went on to play for Jamaica. We had loads of games then popping up. Jamaica versus Nigeria at Loftus Road. You know, there was a bit of a buzz, but it didn't push through in the quality of the football to be able to get to another World Cup. And that's been a massive, massive disappointment for me, that we haven't seen Jamaica push on. But, you know, never say never. For Jamaica to return to the world stage, you know, would mean a hell of a lot to me. And now I've got enough connections to actually be able to get a ticket, I hope, to go and maybe take my kids along as well. They always say a journalist should never reveal who they support, but you know it's impossible, I think, sometimes because of the connection you have with that particular team and that being so strong. So I've always declared an interest, if you like, and my football team is Tottenham Hotspur. The reason for that is I am from Haringey, and as a youngster, my old man took me to go and train at Tottenham, so I train there once a week. Between the ages of like 8 to 12, and absolutely loved every minute of being so connected with that football club. There was, you know, a bit of a disconnect, I guess, in North London, with Tottenham Hotspur at the time. They weren't great in the community and they are amazing in the community now, which is great to see. So actually going to Tottenham Hotspur to train in the ball courts, which was at the stadium, was massive to me. So I had this real connection with Tottenham Hotspur, and the team had some amazing players. Paul Gascoigne and Gary Lineker were the two standout players who played for us at the time. And in 1991, of course, we made it to the FA Cup final. In fact, the last major piece of silverware that we've won, which people will ridicule Tottenham Hotspur for until they put that right. So it's Tottenham Hotspur versus Nottingham Forest, and I'm going to an FA Cup final, and that's off the back of Tottenham beating Arsenal 3-1 in probably, you know, the one of the most enjoyable victories that I've ever enjoyed as a Tottenham Hotspur fan over Arsenal, which was just sensational. It was at the old Wembley. And the old Wembley, for no one who's ever been, had such a magical generated in that old stadium. The Twin Towers, the fact that you had these red seats with no backs on, I don't know, just everything about the old Wembley was just really, really special for me, looking back, and just enjoyed the experience immensely. So, you know, it was a fantastic game against Nottingham Forest. I think everyone wanted Forest to win because You know, it was Clough's, you know, one of his, well, I think it was his opportunity to win the FA Cup. And they played some great football along the way, as had Tottenham Hotspur. I remember in their team, you know, Des Walker, Stuart Pearce, you know, he had some iconic players in that team. And we were very much expected as Tottenham to win it, but it was going to be seen as a tough game. And then Gazza, you know, got sent off in the game for a reckless challenge. You know, the fact that it was an own goal that settled it at the end, and the atmosphere around that game was incredible. But also the personal story for me is, you know, I'd been training at the ground in the ball courts. As Tottenham's bus was, you know, pulling off, well, the players were coming to meet together to go to the final. So I got to kind of get my autographs with people like, you know, David Howells and Paul Allen, who I've subsequently got to know through the PFA and working with him there. And there was one player who was missing, and that was a certain Paul Gascoigne. So everybody was getting, you know, quite worried. You know, the bus was meant to have left White Hart Lane to go to the hotel before the game, and there was no Gazza. And then you hear this screech, and I don't know if it was a Mercedes or a BMW, one of these kind of expensive sports cars. Honestly, Gazza nearly knocked over, you know, two or three children driving into that ground to get on the bus. And it was just so typical of Paul Gascoigne. Everything was so erratic and unorganized and frantic. He jumps out, you know, the big superstar gets straight onto the bus, and then the bus leaves. And, you know, the fact that had happened the day before the game, you know, really stands out to me when you think about what happened in the game. You know, him making, you know, a reckless challenge. I think it was on Gary Charles, and then ending up, you know, being stretchered off himself, and then Tottenham Hotspur going on to kind of win it for Gazza, if you like, after he'd played a starring role. And also what happened after the game is, for the celebrations, my dad happened to know the owner of Wetherspoons Pubs, because his first pub, or one of his first pubs, was in Muswell Hill, where we were had been brought up. So, you know, as a 11-year-old, I got smuggled into the pub and left behind the bar, well, to the corner of the bar, while my dad had a few celebratory drinks. And the Forest youth team was in there. So it was interesting to see their roped off bit, and, you know, just the differences in what it means to win and lose, you know, for two football clubs. And yeah, it was just like an amazing experience to think that was my first final, and to see that story unfold in the way that it did, and actually be even at 11, you know, very close to it, was very special indeed.
So just to go through it then, I've met you mean Tim Martin, the owner of Wetherspoons? Trying to think. If it is him, I've met him, and he's an so I used to work at the one in Twickenham, and he's an imposing man. So I think your dad was very lucky there. The game itself, it's one of the earliest games I actually remember on the cup on the telly. Mm. And there's a few standout things about it that I remember from the day, and I'm just trying to work out if it was something that meant to you, because Spurs had wore Hummel up until that point.
Yes.
But then, yes. And then went to the cup final in the Umbro kit.
And I got that shirt. Yeah, I remember that. And because I remember the interesting thing about the kit for kids, as I was, is it didn't have Holston on the front.
Yeah.
So so for me, I was like, it's almost like this is a great kit, but it's not the proper kit because the players don't wear it. So what am I meant to do with this kind of thing? But then actually that's my only option. So, and I didn't, obviously an 11-year-old, I didn't understand the kids walking around, you know, in shirts advertising alcohol probably isn't the one. So, although I don't seem to have a problem with it these days, but, you know, at the time it was kind of like an issue. I guess, but yeah, it was interesting, yeah, because it was a completely new kit, because we'd worn, you know, like you say, the Hummel kit, which was, you know, again, an iconic kit.
Yeah.
And that kind of relates for me back to, you know, that FA Cup run, you know, where Gazza scored an amazing goal against Portsmouth, the free kick he scored against Arsenal in the semi-final, you know, in the third round. I think we played Blackpool on the windiest day I've ever seen football played. You know, there's so many special things about that, that FA Cup run. I mean, the fact that we played Notts County, who gave us a really, really good game. And again, Gazza had to come and dig us out of problems, and, you know, the great form of Gary Lineker throughout all of that cup run, you know, was really special. And, you know, just little things like Gary Lineker's, like, warm up was completely ahead of its time because he'd come from Barcelona. He wouldn't touch a football for ages in his warm up, whereas the rest of the lads would all come out and just be knocking a football around between each other. He would actually be off, you know, running up and down, just warming up his muscles. And I remember how that was such a standout thing, that he wouldn't touch a football for the first 10 minutes of his warm-up. He'd literally just be running and sprinting and getting his body warm. And the fact that the other players were just in corners, just knocking a football around like they're having a kickabout in the playground, you know, was, you know, a standout memory. And just goes to show how ahead of the time Gary Lineker actually was in terms of his warm-ups. Because now, you know, they don't necessarily come out and just kick a ball around. They come out and actually do the running and get themselves and their muscles properly warmed up.
The thing I wanted to talk about just briefly in the cup run. So how much of the cup run did you see? Did you say, sorry, you went to the Blackpool game?
No, the
this was on the telly.
Yeah, the Blackpool game was away from home, so it wasn't on the telly. But the highlights were on Match of the Day at the time. And I just remember, you know, that game. And they never seen wind like that. The ball was blowing all over the place. And I think they just scraped by Blackpool, if I remember.
Yeah.
Maybe like 1-0 in that game. But it was just such a windy game that it was just so memorable just for that. The Portsmouth game, again, I don't think there was great weather for that. But, you know, there was some shimmy that Gazza did that was just out of this world, that made that game really memorable. And actually, it was, you know, Portsmouth were competitive in that game. I think was that Darren Anderton just coming onto the scene at that time.
Because Portsmouth got to the semis.
Hmm.
Portsmouth got to the semis the year after,
They
got beat by Liverpool at Highbury. It was when Darren Anderson first came in. Am I right to say I'm looking at the results now. I can't remember if that magnificent Gascoigne goal where he just slaloms all the way through and he puts it in on the very edge of the byline. Mm. Was that the Oxford game or was that the winner in Notts County?
I think that was the they're merging into the same game in my head right now. I'll be totally merging into the same game.
That was the tragic thing of the final, wasn't it? Because of the semi final, but also, you know, the free kick. Bear in mind that David Seaman was just about to enter his peak. The free kick was amazing, but that for me was the goal of the competition. But we can't actually remember who it was against. Was that the tragedy of the final a little bit, that he did do what he did because he obviously couldn't control his adrenaline, he couldn't control his emotional response to being expected to be that main man? Was that a bit of a tragedy of the final?
Yeah, I mean it's an interesting one because looking back, obviously it was like such a happy memory for me and all the Tottenham fans. But actually, if you analyse it, you know, it was a very, you know, sad moment for Paul Gascoigne and a sad way to say goodbye to him before he went to Lazio. The fact that he's, you know, taken off on a stretcher in tears. But that was Paul Gascoigne. That was just Gazza was just so unpredictable. You know, the things he did, were just intriguing, out of this world, inappropriate many times. I remember during one of the games that season, there was someone running the line who had one arm, And so, you know, he was waving to the crowd when he was taking a free kick, and my dad was saying, oh, geez, he's taking a mickey. And actually, I thought he was waving at me. I thought, oh, right, okay, hello, you know, and everyone was waving back. But actually, you know, that was him taking a mick out of somebody at the time, which was just a very Gazza thing to do. I think on reflection, he'd be horrified to think that he was taking the mick out of somebody with one arm, albeit an official, which everybody would love to hate.
But, yeah,
you know, just Paul Gascoigne. I mean, he was like my absolute hero as a kid, just watching him, just what he did. But, you know, you just knew that there was something around the corner. He could just lose it. He could just lose it. But that was also, you know, part of the attraction of Gazza, this enigma, this kind of like guy who was just a kid, just a big kid out there. Just a big kid just playing football and, you know, just doing what he did. I don't know. It's difficult to articulate. It's difficult to articulate.
So you go 1-0 down, and what's the feeling? Is it the world's going to end? Or did you have because you played, you know, you were training, you played football yourself. Were you positive, or did you get upset that after that goal goes in?
Yeah, if I remember correctly, it was a Stuart Pearce Thunderbolt free kick that flew in. And, you know, I mean, I was 11. So at the time, you know, as an 11-year-old, I think I never really lost complete hope, because, you know, football was this big, I don't know, this big drama, that was in front of you, and you always kind of thought, no, we'll come back and score. Even with the Gazza free kick against Arsenal, I remember, you know, standing up on my seat and saying to my dad, he's going to shoot. My dad told me, hey, sit down and look, don't be so silly, he's miles out. And it was really interesting because he said it loud enough for everyone around us to hear. So when it went in, everyone was like, your boy knows a thing or two. To about football, you should listen to him more often. And that's what football was. It was that kind of like this other world. So I was, you know, had this hope, but this hope with actual belief. I guess I hadn't been through as many downtimes as I have with Tottenham Hotspur since to have this kind of like naive and green feeling about me that no, we'll get back into this. Even without Gazza, I'm sure we can do something. I remember that game, Paul Stewart stepped up to the mark like I'd never seen before. Like, you know, I'd kind of experienced my experience of him had been, you know, he'd moved into like this kind of holding midfield kind of role, having been a striker who didn't score many goals. And I just remember he stepped up in that game massively, 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 massively. And, there was just a feeling about the team that they were going to do it, that something was going to happen. And, you know, the fact that we eventually did, I mean, you know, I don't like using particular terms. Like football was a difficult place at the time because of the Hillsborough disaster and stuff. So, you know, but when we scored, like the fact that everyone just got pushed onto each other, that for me is like a memory of what football was. It was a scary moment, but it was also a moment when I think back to the rawness of football, how raw and, you know, like the smells, the language was horrible. And I don't know if it was like, obviously I wasn't fond of that, but it created this kind of thing around football that was just so different to any other part of your life, you know, that made it stand out.
With the, you know, we've talked about Paul Stewart, and I think, you know, it was a goal across, was it?
It was an own goal, wasn't it?
No, but Stewart was the one that equalised.
Oh, yes, yeah.
With a goal across the keeper, across Mark Crossley. And obviously, you know, we've forgotten quite a major part was Mark Crossley saving from Lineker, Lineker's penalty, which kind of must have really built up Forrest's hopes and brought your hopes right down. So that itself. So was the fact that it was an own goal. Now, bear in mind, I say this from, you know, I've made it quite clear, and I'm an Evertonian on this. And I always think that when Everton win the cup 4 years later, there's a real anticlimax about the goal, because Graham Stewart should have scored. but he hits the underside of the bar, and no one's realised that Paul Rideout's actually put it in the top corner. And you can hear the delay in the response. So do you have any memories of an anticlimax regarding the fact that it was an own goal, or were you just too busy celebrating?
Yeah, no, I mean the view I had, we were in the lower tier, which I hate to watch football from. I don't know how managers follow games from the lower tier, because I've always sat upper tier all my life watching football and taking an interest in formations and how that all works and being close to the atmosphere, which is the counter argument to being low down. I'm not so bothered about that because I like to see the movement of the players, the formation, etc. But for that FA Cup final, I was lower tier behind the goal. So actually the view I had, all I'd seen was the ball whipped in and then it bulged the back of the net. And I just assumed that Gary Mabbutt had headed it in and didn't actually know until, hadn't had it confirmed until we kind of got home and watched it on the box, the replay, that, Des Walker had put it into his own net. And I was a big fan of Des Walker. You never beat Des Walker. The way he plays, he could bring the ball out. He had so much pace. And the fact that he was from Enfield, so he's, just up the road from Tottenham Hotspur. He's almost like a local. So I was gutted for him, actually. Not at the time. At the time, I was just being kind of moved around the lower tier of Wembley, in the way that football was back then. But no, it was just seeing that net bulge. That's what you see. You see the net bulge. Everyone realizes it's a goal and it goes crazy. And then it's just that feeling of, against all the odds, on this day, we've lost Gazza, we've had a penalty saved, but we've managed to win this cup. It's almost like this is meant to be.
Well, there we go. I really enjoyed that chat with Leon. It was great to finally nail him down and have that chat about what really formed him as a football fan, what his view is, how he's arrived where he is, and what it was like to go and see or to at least enjoy the fact that Jamaica, this small nation, was able to go to the World Cup, and then for him to go on and actually become friends with quite a lot of people involved, I think obviously mattered a lot to him. And it's always great to hear a Paul Gascoigne story as well. But you can get Leon on Twitter at Leon_man. That's MANN. And I think also if you go to leonmann.co.uk, that's his website, and you can catch up on quite a lot of his work there, particularly with BCOMS and also with Football's Blacklist. So yeah, I really hope you enjoyed it as much as we did, and take care. See you soon.